Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody. This is Geert once again on NBN's Drugs, Addiction, and Recovery podcast. Today, I'm talking to Alexandra Bartoszka. Hi, Alexandra. I'm so glad we can talk today.
Hi, thank you for having me here.
So I really enjoyed your book. The book's called Treating Heroin Addiction in Norway, The Pharmaceutical Other, published by Routledge just earlier this year. And it's, I'll leave you to introduce the book in a moment. But before we get to the content, maybe you could tell us a tiny bit more about your academic professional background, so to say, and also how you got to the current topic.
Yeah, sure. Well, I'm a social anthropologist. I did my master at the University of Oslo, and I've been engaged with medical anthropology since then, actually. And then I did my PhD in social work and social policy at the Oslo Metropolitan University. And that's where I did my project, which this book is based on. And now I'm at the Faculty of Social Studies at another specialized university, also in Oslo, working as associate professor here. And how I came to study the addiction, as usually, by coincidence a bit, but I was always interested and engaged with said medical anthropology and how the state and health services and professions are shaping our lived experiences and how they're shaping and reproducing deviances and our ways of thinking about normality and normal body, what's normal life, and what's how we should live our lives, both, you know, bodily, corporally, and socially. And drug and addictions, I was sitting in a train one day reading a newspaper, and I was reading about heroin clinic in Denmark, and I was wondering how does it look in Norway. And it was 2014, 10 years after we had substance treatment reform, when people with substance disorders or addictions or problems received patient rights. So then I realized that I know nothing about this field and nobody wrote about this field, and I want to see how patient rights actually, what kind of impact did they have, and how does it, you know, Norwegian welfare society and state responds to addiction problems, etc. So I went into the field with, you know, as real anthropologists with no previous knowledge about addiction and drugs, etc. So that's how it started. And doing my PhD at the social policy department and social work, so it kind of was a good match for the interest of the social work professions. Mm.
Yeah, I see. What's interesting about your project, as you describe it right now, it's a very broad project with and you spoke to many people, but in the end, the book itself, it's actually more or less about one person. Of course, there's the big background of all the institutions and how, as you say, how they shape what is normal and how the individual has to deal with those institutions. Could you say a bit more, because we'll talk about this individual, the woman called Siv, in a moment, but could you tell us a bit more about the broad research project? Like, what kind of people did you speak to?
Well, so I started, as I said, with the really huge question, how does the patient rights affect people with addiction? And I started to approach this field through, you know, various organizations doing work with drug use, etc. And then I started to talk to people and then I met Sif, actually, because somebody told me that she knows someone who is struggling with her substitution treatment, and she's quote, applying her patient rights to get the right medication. So of course I was intrigued, and then I went and met Sif, who is the person in the book, and through Sif, actually, she kind of opened the whole field, and she kind of designed the field for me, because it was through her personal story I got in touch with her friends, with other professions, with other researchers, with other people engaged or working or being patients in opioid substitution treatment. So the whole project kind of started with Siv, but then I my whole fieldwork kind of covered 7-8 patients with this type of problems as Siv experiences this book. But then for the book, I kind of edited the old story to make it more clear. So I talked and observed and did the, you know, ethnographic traditional fieldwork, you can see, with patients in treatment and outside the treatment. And I was traveling through the whole Norway, because many of patients had their treatment teams in other parts of the Norway. That's why I called it person-centered, multi-sided fieldwork, because I was following one person, but all those individuals had their networks all over the Norway. So I was kind of following person, but also had to change the site of where their care was happening. So that's kind of the view. And I was doing it through 2 years, I guess.
I see. And well, the obvious relation, if the obvious question now is, who is Siv? Maybe you can tell a tiny bit of her situation and her background, and perhaps also your relationship with her.
Well, so Siv was when I met her. I mean, the book is kind of retrospective of our meetings, but also when I met her, she was currently in opioid substitution treatment, which is treatment for people who had heroin or have heroin addiction on dependence. And she was using and being addicted to heroin for like 20 years before I met her. And she was in treatment in methadone, and she was in various treatment for a few years, and the last treatment she received was with morphine, which she received from her psychiatrist. And when I met her, she was transferred to opioid substitution treatment, where the doctors wanted to change her medication, despite the what we can call good results, as they wrote in the reports, despite stabilized situation, both like socially, personally, economically, etc. After 3 years, the doctors wanted to change her treatment modality. And when I met Siv, she was in in the process of complaining. She said complaints to the health boards, to, you know, the all the relevant instances regarding her treatment. So I was following her struggle through those 2 years to keep morphine and not to change into buprenorphine, the other preferred modality.
Mm. Yeah, I see. Maybe because you already hinted to it, maybe you can explain what her situation is when it comes to the dichotomy between addiction and dependence, because that's a very important distinction for you, I guess.
Yeah. That's why I say she was addicted, because when I met her, I would define her more as dependent, not addicted. And I do make a point about it in the book, because we in Norwegian language we do not have language for these distinctions between addiction as, you know, overwhelming engagement with drugs or any other substances which does influence your life to such a degree that you are, you know, damaging your social and personal relation, you are not functioning socially, economically, etc. Why dependence is the kind of non-overwhelming engagement with drugs, which was a case for Siv, who was consuming morphine every day, twice a day, but she had a good life, she had a family, she was doing some small jobs, she was paying her rent, you know, she was living her life without the overwhelming she experienced while she was addicted to heroin. Then, as she said, nothing else matters. And now she uses opiates just to, you know, function well, to be a whole human being, as she said, right? To be a normal person, as she experienced it. And in treatment, we do not have this distinction, but both Sif and her friends, they do their own language to distinguish between those two states of being, and they are really clear about it. She said that I'm not, she don't use the term addicted, but she say I'm not hustling and rushing, right? So we use this picture when we are talking to students about what addiction is. So we are talking about, you know, the Gollum from Lord of the Rings, my pressure, right? Nothing else matters. And Sif was talking about her previous addiction and engagement with heroin in those terms. But now she was stable and dependent. And that's the distinction which was important for her. And that's why it had to be important to me, as I was following her own understandings.
Yeah, I see. And in that sense, it's interesting how her, because in the essence, her problem is that she wants to use morphine because that works best for her to live a normal life. But the program as set up by Norwegian government, I guess, or Norwegian law and the clinical practitioners doesn't really allow for that divergence from the usual substances. Can you maybe, because I think it's the third chapter, it's called Pharmaceutical Atmospheres, if I translate that into my own words, it's about the social, the political, and the moral context in which a certain phenomenon finds itself, maybe also the history. Could you tell us tiny bit more about the development of, or about the history of opioid substitution therapy in Norway?
Sure. So in comparison to Europe or the North America, Norway was pretty late with opioid substitution treatment because of the tradition we had both politically regarding, but also clinically and socially, tradition for non-medical treatment, a kind of treatment of substance use and addiction without using medications. So it was first in 1997 when the HIV epidemic has come to Norway, or kind of we started to have some instances of contagion. Then it became allowed to use methadone for people who were infected with HIV first, and then the program started to be national. And in 2001, it became more available for other people who are not infected with HIV. And in 2001, we started to also import or introduced buprenorphine and another medication. And after that, we had another medication. So the development started to go kind of parallel with other countries. But because it was pretty new in Norway, also the professionals working with addiction was in many ways unprepared for this kind of population. And in particular, that we received the substance treatment reform when people with addiction received patient rights and was transformed to health care was really really huge surprise to many of the both nurses and the doctors, because earlier it was social workers who were working with this population. So it was kind of combination of new phenomena, new ways of seeing addiction treatment and substitution, and new patient population, which suddenly arrived from day one at the table of the doctors not prepared to handle it, is my guess.
Okay, and so it was part of social work before. Was it also like an outright criminal issue before?
You mean?
Were the users just criminalized before?
Yeah, and they still are.
Mm-hmm.
So So that's also one of the point of the book, right? That becoming a patient and becoming a subject of medical intervention doesn't mean that all the other contexts like criminalization disappear, because SIF was still under the criminal, she was still criminalized if she wanted to use any other substances than those prescribed. So the situation regarding criminal issues is still the same.
Okay, that's I found that the key question of your book seems to be it revolves about this patient's agency, because the story is basically about SIF in negotiation and in a sort of battle with the institutions, and. Yeah, on the one hand, you make a very strong statement that to just focus on the factors that have determined SIV's situation, so to say, is not necessarily the only story. It's because SIV, in located in her own life, feels that she has a very strong agency and that she's dealing with her situation in with all the force she can. But would you say that the law or the medical industry, so to say, do they see a drug user as a full agent, so to say? Are they fully responsible for themselves, or partly responsible, or how do they see that?
I don't know. I haven't spoken to pharmaceutical industry, so I'm not sure what they think. But what kind of agency do they ascribe to? They do sell the narrative of agent, of responsible subject, like patients, that the whole story about addiction as a disease is driving pharmaceutical industry. Without this discourse and this story, they would not be able to prepare medications, right? And to sell story about the disease, you have to acknowledge patient's agency, because that's how you do this, right? And mm-hmm. And also because it is so I guess indirectly they do ascribe some kind of agency to patients, but I've never thought about it actually.
No, that's all right. Maybe I was going on a tangent. It's how would you say that when it comes to the pharmaceutical atmosphere, so to say, how would you say the phenomenon of OST is currently viewed by, I guess, wider society or maybe politics? Is it a salient issue, so to say?
Is it a
pressing issue, so to say? Is our political opinions very much divided on the existence of it?
It's changed. I mean, you know, the whole drug and addiction field, it's always polarized, right? Because it depends first, what do you think of the drug use in general? And it would always influence how you think about treating addiction. It has changed since the first notions and discussion about introducing methadone and buprenorphine, the whole discussion about, you know, state as a dope, as a dealer, you know, medicine as a dope, the whole discussion is kind of, it's not totally absent, but in the clinical and professional setting, it's less intense or less loaded, at least, you know, explicit, because you can track it through the practices, right? That they're still treating medicines as kind of dope because they can, you know, you can get high, for instance, right? But in the general public in Norway has changed kind of this understanding a lot. I mean, this is also because of the efforts made lately through towards the drug policy reform, when the disease story engaged a lot of people, right? So while you tell the public that this is a disease, so people also change the way they see the medicine. So it's changing, I think
mm-hmm. makes sense. Maybe because the habits of the clinicians, so to say, are very much shaping Siv's experience, I guess, and in extent the experience of many of the users that are enrolled in these programs. Could you maybe explain the concept of pharmacotopia? Because I think it's rather key to understand what happens to these people.
Yeah, it is. And what I mean with pharmacotopia is this kind of idealized image of pharmaceutical efficacy or effects, like the story about the universalism of medicines, which are reproduced and believed in the clinical settings, and it's overly optimistic view of how medicines are working, because they do follow the standardized patients and standardized individuals, and are based on clinical trials and clinical studies, which follow, you know, all the rules you have to do clinical studies, but they are always based on kind of, you know, group and population thinking. And we always have such individuals as Sif or some other individual who, you know, who are at the margins of those studies and those effects or efficacies. And that, you know, Sif's story challenged this pharmacotopic view of what do we mean but medication is working, because it was always both interesting for me, and she also wanted to, you know, get understanding what the doctors mean by buprenorphine working. What do you mean by methadone working? It doesn't work for me, but it works for somebody else. My effects are your side effects, and your side effects are what I want, right? So pharmacotopia is this, you know, idealized imaginary of clinical work or clinical effects, which, you know, doesn't really match with the individual experiences in real life, post-market, I would say.
Okay, in that case, I wonder, because I understand the mechanism, but maybe it's good to make the contrast with a different medication. For instance, if you take something like insulin, something sort of, well, basic in my opinion, if you take insulin, your blood sugar plummets. Why isn't, I would say in such a case, pharmacotopia or this image of medical efficacy is more legitimate than in the case of OST, opioid substitution therapy. Why is the difference so big? Because if you give somebody buprenorphine or methadone, their addiction problem isn't necessarily solved.
Yeah, it's depending what you are searching from medication, right? I think there are much more differences within the population doing drugs, and there are various reasons for why they are using opioids or heroin or methadone. Why with, you know, insulin, it may be much more homogeneous, but I know that many of anthropologists working with insulin would also could argue the difference, right? And we know from the, you know, study of Anita Hardon and all people working with the history of pharmaceuticals, as a, you know, every medicine has their own effects depending on the individuals. So, but because, you know, regarding agency, right, because we tend to ascribe some, you know, dirty motives or suspect people with addiction, then those differences became put under the suspicions too. And that's why doctors are kind of strengthening their own story. Because, you know, if your story as a clinician is threatened, so you are strengthening this story even more, right? So even if you are, you know, understanding that, okay, there are individual differences in people effects, but we cannot allow that, you know, every addicted person comes to me and tell about their own preferences, right? So I don't know. I at least experienced that there is kind of threat to the story, to the clinical story, because a thief knows what works for her, so she's challenging, you know, the clinical study, which say something else.
Yeah, I agree with this sort of suspicion. This image that you have of somebody who uses this kind of drugs, opioids, for instance, that you feel like, okay, well, maybe there might be some kind of part of their personality that's just on the hunt for another kind of high, kind of rush.
But it's also right, you know, you can also, in using opioids, you can do some measurements in blood, right? In blood, you can measure, you know, how people react. And that's also what clinical studies say about the difference that, you know, we don't see any difference in measurements of your, you know, opioid receptors coverage, et cetera, et cetera. But people still don't feel well. And it's, you know, it's related to the individual understanding of normality, right? And your previous experiences, because my needs may be totally different than your needs, because maybe I experienced something bad in my past and I need to, you know, deal with it on the other level. And that's why I need 1 milligram more of buprenorphine than you, right? Even if my blood measures say anything else, that it's, you know, okay. So I think that's, you know, again, the what is well-being and what is the threshold of well-being, right? What do you need to function better to get energy to, you know, to do your everyday stuff.
Yeah, I found that a very, very strong, I think it was citation, I don't remember the person's name, but you cite this other person that you speak to, and they take one of the magic, sorry, that's my doorbell.
Oh, yay!
I won't open that, and that's for somebody else. anyway, no, they you ask them, is your medication working? And they actually give like this very nuanced take of that on the one hand, yeah, the kind of cravings and the, what you call that, the withdrawal effects are gone. But I guess they, well, they don't make the second part explicit, but they also say that, okay, well, the reason why I started taking opioids in the first place, that isn't helped in any way by the medication.
Right.
I found that a very strong illustration of, the, of this part.
Yeah, and that's also why, you know, the quote of Sif, which I found very strong, when she said that I was never healthy on buprenorphine, right? That, okay, I don't have, I don't shake, I don't have, you know, anxieties, I don't have withdrawals, and I'm not sweating, but I'm not healthy, right? So it's also, again, what do we mean by working, as one of my interlocutors said? What does it mean that medication works? And for whom, right? And how would do we measure it?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So,
agreed. Okay, but then the question arises, I guess, how might this kind of working, this definition of a working medicine beyond just the first biological, first physical effects, do you think there might be a way to incorporate that in the clinical studies as such, or maybe in the clinical practice?
Yeah, but clinical studies and then practice, they are dependent on the measurable sizes, right? How you can measure well-being. And it also is fluctuating, right? Because it can vary from day to day, et cetera, et cetera. So, but yeah, of course, you have, as the new working of the revised version of the guidelines for OST now, which is under the hearings, should incorporate, for instance, more qualitative studies, which would support the idea of individuality and well-being, which is not, which we are not able to measure in numbers, but so we'll see if they will became knowledge base. But it is difficult to satisfy clinical studies and guidelines without measurements. And you know, people also don't have language for it because this is so bodily and corporal. So this is really difficult to translate and to put the words on what do you mean it's working, I'm now fine, right? And it can't, the only way I see it could be possible to give people chance to, you know, choose the medication they would like, they prefer, and let's see if they, you know, start complaining, start, you know, urging for something else, if they start to do you know, start or stopped using other medication and just follow the prescribed ones, right? So I think to, you know, broaden the window of opportunity to check what actually works for the individual. I guess it could be, you know, to give people a chance.
Yeah,
and that's what happened with Sif. She was given chance, ironically, right, during those 2 years she was struggling. At the same time, she was allowed to keep staying on morphine, which was arguing is very risky for her. At the same time, she was allowed to stay in it. And she, you know, maybe that's also why she was able to win this this struggle, because she kind of confirmed with her, you know, body and good result that her choice was good for her.
Yeah. Yeah, so that might be that might suggest that at least in the that at least in some cases more autonomy for the patient first of all, but also for the I don't know, the GP or the principal clinician on a case, there should be a bit more autonomy and a bit more possibility for trying things out, at least in, well.
Yeah, and I'm very happy that you said, because it's not always, because the giving and full autonomy to patients or whatever, the, you know, decisive power to the patients has also the box side. So I'm not, you know, promoting for, you know, patients becoming doctors, because this is also some, as I also write in the book, that there are some part of knowledge that we do not have access to, and that also Steve and other did trust the doctors. But GPs, right, who are much more able to have a better relationship with patients than the doctors in specialized healthcare when the opioid substitution treatment in Norway is, they should definitely get much more autonomy, because they are able, you know, family doctors, etc., that they could, they know, they have much more capacity to work also in, you know, social work context. They know family, they know contact, they know other other troubles they have, etc. So absolutely, and we see also changes here in Norway that GPs are starting to you know, to tell their story and their needs and want to receive much more patients. Not everybody, right? But
you mentioned that it that the GPs are also quite key. You know, that the GPs are also closer to the social work part. Would you say that by putting the OST more in the medical field, it's also missing out on something? Would you say that there were certain things that were better before this change in Norwegian law?
Well, I would not say it was better, but in theory, OST is, you know, cooperation. You have this, you have GP, it should be collaboration between GPs, specialized healthcare, and social work. But in practice, you have both prestige and profession struggles, etc., and also time constraints, when in practice, it is medical doctors at the end who are responsible for the, you know, for making the prescriptions. And in the, as such an ISIF case, social workers following her, they were really, really supportive of her choice. They really took a lot of struggle for Sif in front of the doctors. But in the end, it's the one who are making the prescriptions who have the decisive power. So if the practice would be as it is meant, that it is a real cooperation between social work, GPs, and specialized healthcare, it would be, you know, ideal situation with the patient in the center, etc. So it would be great. But and that's also why we do have a lot of how you call it, change of the, you know, a lot of social workers and young doctors are switching back from working in OST, because they do feel they do not have a lot of space to do good judgments, because the rules and the guidelines are so strict that they feel that even if they, you know what's good for the patient, even if they know the whole story, they, you know, been with Sif in 5 years, etc., etc., so the rules are so difficult to exercise the discretion, or how we call it, that a lot of them quit. So we have a huge turnout. No, how you call it?
Turnover.
Yeah, turnover. Yeah. And then you know, new professional comes, which are unsure about how to proceed. So they stick to the guidelines, and the story repeats every time with many patients.
Yeah, that's.
But definitely more social work, but not only, because, you know, we do need medical knowledge. We do need medical people because it is, you know, this is medicine we are talking about. So in the context when the drug are criminalized, of course, I have to say that, because it is underlying everything we are talking about. Because if we do not have criminal issues, so people do not need maybe to search to apply for being patient UST, because they can get legal substances without the regime that which treatment is which treatment involves. Does it make sense?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it just makes me think. I mean, I'm a lay person in this field, but I do see a parallel with some acquaintances that, for instance, they take antidepressants or they take some kind of what do you call it, SSRI blockers. Mm. Neurologically active medication in correspondence with collaboration with a psychiatrist, and you see that with many of those kinds of medications where people are dealing with severe mental health issues that might be related to some kind of chemical imbalance in their brain, or that's part of the story at least. But you also see a big back and forth and a real trial and error with all the different medications, for instance, antipsychotics or antidepressants, what have you, that they try a certain medication and then it's not working at all, or it gives super bad side effects. So in that situation, sometimes it seems that part of this uncertainty about how pharmaceutically created medication in the end turns out to work in an individual life, like with this kind of person of a psychiatrist, it seems seems sort of to work, at least the trial and error process. I'm not saying that the problem is solved, but at least the bad medications are filtered out.
Yeah, and that's what I meant by giving a chance, right? And it's maybe not, you know, appropriate language to you know, to describe the, you know, clinical procedure, but that's what I meant, that when it comes to OST, you have, you know, two, maybe three medications, and often you are not asked about, you know, side effects, or maybe we should go down or up with the dosage, etc. So people do not have so many choices as in other contexts and diseases, etc. And, you know, and that's also why many patients, you know, are still disappointed, because they thought that now we are, you know, ordinary real patients because we have a patient's right. So maybe we will have the opportunity also to try different medication, to hear, you know, if I go to the doctor and take, you know, pain medication, he always asked how am I, and if I, you know, experience, you know, nightmares or whatever. And then many of those patients do not get this treatment. And so trial and errors, yeah, should be allowed. Mm. In particular, because, you know, this is, if you talk about population, this population of people who, you know, have been using all possible combinations, all possible dosages the last 20, 30 years of their lives. So that, you know, the fear of maybe we overdose patients with 1 milligram of methadone or buprenorphine, it's really strange, to put it bluntly, you know, because this is not, you know, reality based fear, because people, their bodies and they, you know, the bodies are so experienced and they are so experienced with the medication that it shouldn't make any difference. Even if, you know, methadone and buprenorphine, they are different when it comes to risk profile, etc., in clinical studies, but in real life, they do not differ if patients is not fornate, when patient is not satisfied with medication, they do handle side effects or, you know, not working with other medications. So they do combine and do the polydrug use, etc. So the risk profile of the medication from clinical studies do not, again, match with the reality that people experience in the real life.
Yeah, yeah. I guess these individuals might also indeed be a bit more willing to take different kinds of small risks. Okay, I think we've covered a lot of ground also perhaps beyond the book, but it was all very relevant. So thanks for that. I have a couple of more questions. So I found your book extraordinarily readable. And that's, of course, in part because of, well, it's an anthropological study, so there will be a lot of narratives. And, of course, as a reader, we love narratives. But would you say that that it would be a good idea for is it a method that might be applied to other fields of science? Because you give a lot of you sketch a lot of background and you give a lot of technical material, but in the end, there's a big thread in there sketching a personal story. Is this something that you would say that it might be useful for other fields as well? Or is this specific for anthropology?
Yeah, of course. As you said, you know, ethnography, we do believe that, you know, ethnographical descriptions and empirical description has a value in itself. That's why that's the one thing that we know at least I do, and I do appreciate empirical material as such, which would give me reflection and you know, a ground for further analytical work. That's one thing. And and also to, you know, humanize or, you know, people, we should people our, you know, studies and our material, because much, in particular in this field, much of the studies and work I had to read to familiarize with the field, they do not involve people. Like you have or numbers or histories or anonymized stories which are, you know, devoted from any uniqueness, because you do want to present always the, you know, standardized patient or standardized story. So it could be helpful maybe in practical or clinical settings, etc., that you can recognize yourself in it. So I would definitely challenge any other disciplines to give me more people, more stories, more real life. But you know, this is a balance, of course, like not too much story and that.
Evidently.
And also do not be afraid to, you know, to, because I had, you know, I had some rants about SIF and how, what kind of value it would have to present just one story. Right. And so I would encourage people to not be afraid to follow just a few or just one person, because through one person, you can get a book, right? You can get so many stories, because one individual life has so many layers, both politically, bodily, you know, socially, etc. So she was my, you know, she was my light into the field of OSD, which I would not be able if I would take the other way around and start it with, you know, well-defined field and start to find people there, because it would define what kind of people I would find first, and then it would be totally different story, I guess. So here to the people.
Yeah, there's one final thing. So you already touched upon the recent changes in Norwegian drug-related laws when it comes to criminalization and decriminalization of possession, I think, use. I'm not sure. Could you say a bit more about that, and also whether and how that affects your own studies?
When I did this project, so the discussions were not, I mean, the, the drug policy reform has been discussed in, you know, various fora, and political parties took initiatives here and there, but it was first for 3 years ago. I mean, it became a real issue, and the health minister decided to vote for the reform, which was not voted this year. So we are not going to have the reform, at least now. And how does it change my, you know, my further work and my studies? First, people started to get interested in the field of drugs, right? Because now you can, because of the discussion and because of the voting and the whole story, people who has never had any meaning or, you know, any opinion about drugs, or had really strong opinions which were not knowledge based, as we can see, so they started to open, to be more open to you know, new insights and new stories, and in the clinics people are starting to be prepared that the situation in few years maybe will change, and how are we going to react when we will not longer have this, you know, disciplinary, you know, obligation, or what, you know, the way we see our patient would lack the criminal perspective, which they do also have to relate to, because when they are prescribing medication, they do have to consider how this medication can be, for instance, be sold on the street, etc., etc. And if you, you know, if you take the criminal and judicial part from the picture, so it would, I don't want to, you know, to read in the future, but I think that it definitely would change some narratives and some, you know, some moral conceptions of the drug use. And then we, of course, we have to be prepared for what, you know, the disease making would end with, because now we risk that everybody who are using substance use may be defined as ill and diseased, and this is also the darker part of the medicalization story, right? Not everyone who is using substances becomes addicted or dependent, but as the reform was proposed, so it would end with everybody being defined as sick and, you know, in chance of becoming a patient. So I think I would really like to open, you know, for more discussions about the disease making of people who use substances in Norway, because we are definitely lacking this discussion. Because as, you know, Stefan Jonke said, as I write in the conclusion, what else can you do? You have the two choices right now. You have, or you are being criminal and get punished, or you are becoming patient and get treatment. And of course, most people who, you know, want well and have some kind of knowledge prefer treatment, but is it the way to, you know, SIF could maybe have had better without treatment and without treatment, you know, regime and that's one. So another story.
Speaking of other stories, what are you writing on, working on right now?
So speaking about drug reform, I was following Siv actually after this project, because she was engaged in a user initiative in the context of drug policy reform, because the user, okay, when health minister appointed the committee to, you know, the working group to propose the legislation, they invited two drug user representatives, which is okay in the political settings, but many of the drug users, if I can use, you know, general term, were not satisfied with the choice of the minister. They meant that those representatives do not represent us. They are not real drug users. They do not stand for what we stand. And, you know, the whole representation discussion suddenly burst out, and some of the users, including Siv, they engaged and organized some protest, and they organized a shadow committee, a group which wanted to deliver alternative report to health minister, which would be based on the user voices and their own experience, etc. So I was following Siv in totally different context, which was not treatment related, but drug and activist policy related. So it's kind of side effect of the original project and our relations that we were able to, you know, reconnect after some time. So yes, I'm working about, wrote an article about this shadow committee now, and now want to develop some work on the representation of drug use, and then we see. I'm done with the book, so now I'm open for, you know, new inspiration.
Really cool. Thank you very much for sharing. I think that's we covered so much. So, well, thanks once again, Alexandra, and I hope to talk soon. Maybe over another book. You never know.
Yeah, hope so. Thank you for having me.